Good evening and welcome to Outsources, a weekly KGNU program that provides you with content by and for queer communities in Colorado. I'm your host, Sean Kenny, and tonight I'm talking with Aaron Marcus from History Colorado. Aaron is the Gill Foundation Associate Curator of LGBTQ plus History, and this coming month, History Colorado will feature a groundbreaking exhibition entitled Rainbows and Revolutions, which highlights Colorado's LGBTQ plus movement from the 1950s through today. Aaron, thanks so much for joining me on Outsources today.
Thank you for having me, Sean. Good to be back.
Yes, we spoke a couple years ago, actually right before lockdown was happening. There was a lot going on at that time, and a lot has happened since then, I'm guessing.
Well, and literally, I think we spoke the day before lockdown started.
Right. So I'm very curious to kind of catch up with you on how your work is going at History Colorado, what you've been up to in that time. And I want to dedicate a lot of our conversation today to talking about this Rainbows and Revolutions exhibition that's coming up at History Colorado. But before we jump in, for those who might be unfamiliar with you and the work that you're doing with History Colorado, can you just talk a little bit about your role there and how you've seen your work there kind of take shape over the past couple years?
Yes, definitely. So my current role as the Associate Curator of LGBTQ plus History was a brand new role. If you remember correctly. And so I've kind of had to build the role myself. Of course, I have a museum background, and I kind of knew what to expect. But honestly, when I got into it, being an actual curator, it was a lot more than what I was planning. It's a lot of reaching out to the community, basically asking people to give us their stuff that a lot of people find precious. The very first thing I brought in was a poster, and the gentleman who donated it was his partner's. And so he's hung on to it for many decades because his partner passed away from AIDS. And so he's had this and wanted to put it somewhere where it would be safe and protected. So when he donated it and he was signing the paperwork, it was very emotional. He cried. And so there was this personal human connection aspect that I wasn't really expecting, which, don't get me wrong, I totally love. But that part took a lot more effort than I was anticipating.
I can only imagine. So a lot of what you're doing then in this role, and as you said, the inaugural role at History Colorado, is building a kind of archival materials of LGBTQ plus history in Colorado. Is that right? So that takes you all over the state.
Exactly. So in building the archive, the official name is the Gill LGBTQ Archive. The Gill Foundation has funded my position up until now. Originally, it was for 2 years, and they're the sole sponsor of the exhibit. And then we applied for a third year, which is what we're in right now. So the exhibit will open June 4th, and a lot of what I have been bringing in, like, let me go back just a little bit. So when I started this position, History Colorado had very little in LGBTQ resources, archives, artifacts. I did, it's called a special collection. If you go to our website and look at our online collection, if you go under collection highlights, LGBTQ plus, I built a special collection there so people can go and just see what we have. Well, when I started, I believe there was 94 items in our collection, and I just updated this with the exhibit coming up, and hopefully people will be more interested in donating in the future. I just updated this special collection, and now it has over 500 items, and that's just what I've had time to process in the last 2 years. There's many more that still need to be processed and put into the online collection.
Yeah, I can only imagine that, you know, when tasked with collecting, telling the story, building an archive of LGBTQ plus histories in Colorado, I mean, what a monumental task that must be. So I'm curious, as we think about specifically Rainbows and Revolutions now, this exhibition at History Colorado, people aren't getting all 500, right, pieces. This is a kind of edited down collection. But what can people expect as they're walking in? What are they going to see, hear, experience in this exhibit?
Yeah, you're correct in that obviously all artifacts can't be in the exhibit. The exhibit will be in the Ballantine Gallery, which is off the atrium, and it's only less than 1,000 square feet. So in trying to tell 50 plus years of history, in that amount of space is not easy. And so I'm hoping that everybody sees at least something they identify with or they see themselves in. And if they don't, then I hope they contact me and donate so that they will in the future when we do another exhibit. So in this exhibit, it's kind of a quick survey, if you will, of LGBTQ history in Colorado, because, again, time and space constraints. But we'll start in the 1950s, the Mattachine Society. We'll begin there, and then, of course, the Stonewall Uprising that kicked off what many consider the modern gay rights movement. I always like to preface that with, the movement had been going on long before. There's many people that I wish I could mention everybody because they were so integral to the fight long before Stonewall. But we don't have time for me to sit here and tell you everybody. Anyhow, but the exhibit it'll start out in the late 19th century with a little background information. And then it really does kick off in the 70s. So in the 1970s, that's when, you know, Big Mama Rag started, Woman to Woman Bookstore, Category 6, the revolt on city council in 1973. I'm not sure if you're aware of that or not, but that's a really interesting story. That will be highlighted because that happened October 23, 1973, led by Jerry Garash and four other people who formed the Gay Coalition of Denver. And so they were trying to get the indecency laws overturned because back then the cops would target gays and gay men and lesbians just for walking across street jaywalking, you'd get a ticket. And so anyways, that's what the revolt on city council was all about, was having our voices heard. And it was tough going. The president of the city council didn't want to hear from these over 300 people that showed up to pack the room. But 36 people did get to speak, and by the end of it, they did get four laws overturned. So that'll be a big part of the exhibit. Again, Big Mama Rag, some amazing stuff from the women who were part of that. I kind of, in my head, I have it set up by decades, but it's not really like that. Since, you know, the history bleeds into each decade, but in my head, that's how I try to keep track of it. 1980s, we have to talk about HIV and AIDS. You know, it's not a fun topic by any means. It devastated the community. I have done a couple of really great oral histories that talk about this and what these people were going through at this time, just how they had to change the way they were living their life, how the community changed, how Capitol Hill changed, all because of this horrible disease. As listeners, and you are probably well aware, the 80s was when it really took hold. Then the 90s, Amendment 2, I brought in so much stuff about Amendment 2. And I think it's most of the people who were involved in that fight. And for anybody who doesn't know Amendment 2, it was Colorado for Family Values in Colorado Springs put this on the ballot in November 1992. Basically to take away any protections for LGBTQ plus people. Aspen, Boulder already had non-discrimination laws on the books. Denver had just passed one, which was what spurred Colorado for Family Values into action, because then they started saying special rights. And it wasn't that. But I've brought in a lot of items from that from the people who were actually in that fight. Like one gentleman, Frank Brown, slept on the Supreme Court steps the night before to hear the oral arguments the next day. He volunteered for CLIT, Colorado Legal Initiatives Project. And so I have one gentleman, Joseph Marcioni, who fought with EPOC to try to get Amendment 2 not even pass. And then when it did, then Frank's story picks up with the fight to get it overturned by the Supreme Court. So again, Amendment 2 is a large part of that section just because all those people are now retiring. And I don't think you would argue with me. Anybody will argue with me that COVID is horrible, messed up the entire world. But for my collecting, all the people stuck at home got to go through their basements, crawl spaces, attics. So as soon as the lockdown restrictions were eased up, it really picked up for me. I was running all over town picking up donations.
That's so interesting. I was curious how COVID might have affected the work that you're doing. And actually, you know, I can see how you would actually there was an improvement because people were home. Maybe it was even easier to talk to them because they had more time available to be able to touch base and do oral histories or as you're saying, dig through their own kind of artifacts that they have to see what they might want to donate. I'm curious. I know it's probably like as a historian, you're not allowed to pick favorites, but is there a piece in this exhibition that you're really excited about or that you maybe even that's personally meaningful to you and the work that you've been doing at History Colorado so far?
Oh, it's funny you say it that way because it is hard for me to pick one item. I mean, they all seem like my babies, everything I brought in, and I want everything in this exhibit. And we did have to, you know, pick and choose what goes in, trying to represent the entire community. Because as I'm sure you're well aware, our community is still pretty segregated. So it's tough in trying in this space to get everything in to tell everybody's stories. There's some stuff I didn't even know about, like that poster I told you about, 1942. It was a very special place to this gentleman because that's where he met the love of his life. But on the flip side of that, there was a lot of protests against the owner of that bar because it's the discrimination against anybody who basically wasn't white. He owned 3 bars, I believe it was, and they all got picketed. And so that's a story I didn't know until I started this. For instance, all the Amendment 2 stuff, back when in the 1990s when I started going out, I guess just my group of friends wasn't like these other groups because, you know, my life then was about working and going out, and now I'm talking to all these people who were fighting. Like, I didn't even know Epoch existed. I didn't know Clip existed. So that's been a really interesting part for me is knowing how much I don't know before this started.
And for listeners, can you just say a little bit about Epoch and Clip they may be unfamiliar?
Oh, yeah. Epoch was the Equal Protection Campaign, and they were formed to fight Amendment 2. So Amendment 2, people honestly did not think it was going to pass. There was another in Oregon. They had their own law that they were doing at the exact same time. And everyone thought that it would pass in Oregon and not in Denver, or in Colorado, I should say. And so when all of the numbers, the polling numbers started coming in, it had it at about 53% fail, 47% pass, and it ended up just the opposite. It passed by 53%, 47% against it. So in Oregon, with about the same law, their verbiage was so much more hateful. They figured that's why it didn't pass. Whereas Amendment 2, if anybody reads that text, it's confusing. Like, even for us, who we know how we want to vote, if you read it, you like scratch your head and it's like, wait, is this no or yes? Because of the way it was worded very oddly. And so in Joseph Marchione's oral history, we talk about this, and they have one last focus group 2 weeks before the election. And they didn't think it was going to pass. Everybody's like, no, this is wrong. This is wrong. And one woman, he said, was just sitting there this whole time. And so then finally at the end, they called on her and they're like, oh, you've been quiet. Is there anything you want to add? And she goes, you know, I have nothing against gays, but I don't think they should have special rights. And that was the first time Joseph said he'd heard that. It was 2 weeks until the election. There was no way to, they spent all their money. President Clinton was running that year. All the ad space had been sold. So right when he heard that, though, in that focus group, he knew there was probably going to be trouble.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outsources on KGNU. I'm your host, Sean Kenny, and I'm talking with Aaron Marcus, the Gill Foundation Associate Curator of LGBTQ+ History at History Colorado. We're talking about Rainbows and Revolutions, an upcoming exhibition at History Colorado that highlights LGBTQ+ history in the state from the 1950s to the present day. One thing that's coming to mind for me as you're talking about this exhibition is the importance of it and why now. I'm curious if you have any thoughts. I mean, obviously, the importance of knowing our histories, where we've been, but do you have any thoughts about why, you know, in this moment, it's so important to have an exhibition like Rainbows and Revolutions at History Colorado?
Yeah, it's important to have this exhibition for a couple reasons, honestly. As far as I'm aware of, and people at History Colorado, because we've looked into it, this is the first time a state agency has put on an exhibition about LGBTQ history. Here not too long ago, you might know more about this than I do. I think it was Missouri in their state capitol. They had a small exhibit put up, and it was just panels. I think it was three or four panels that the university there did, and that got taken down. You know, just this little panel show, if I'm remembering correctly, was taken down because people working at the Capitol complained about it. So the fact the state of Colorado is hosting an exhibit like this, putting on an exhibit like this, is historic in its own right. I feel it's important right now because there's a lot going on in our community. For instance, all the transphobia going on is out of control. And so we do address that in the exhibit. One of my interns that I had and a temporary employee for a while, she's done an amazing oral history with Dr. Marcy Bowers, who took over for Dr. Biber in Trinidad, who used to do all the sexual affirmation surgeries there. And she did one with Representative Brianna Titone, who's great. Brianna's so great.
Representative Titone is the first openly trans elected state representative, correct?
Correct. Yeah, and in my research, I actually found in Arvada on their city council, they had a transgender woman who was on their city council. It did not go so well for her back in 1991. She was basically forced out of her political career, but she sounded like an amazing woman. She's no longer with us. Otherwise, I would love to have spoken with her. So to go back to your original question, why it's so important is for people to see this history. And again, this isn't going to be really in depth, but I hope it will at least get people thinking or doing a little research on their own. As I said, I've brought in over 500 items, and what's going to be in the exhibit? Maybe 150. So if people find anything interesting in the exhibit, they can go up to our research center and pull any of the other stuff I've brought in and read up on it or read more about it. So yeah, it's just an important time. I mean, right now with Texas and Florida, everything going on, the Don't Say Gay bill, and that's why this is very important. And if one kid could come in there and see themselves in it, I would be happy. I would be thrilled with that.
Yeah, I think there's something, too, I wonder about. I've witnessed people feeling a bit hopeless about the times that we find ourselves in and the kind of, as you're saying, the backlash against particularly trans youth. Something about understanding the battles that have been fought in the past as a way of understanding that, you know, we're a part of something much larger than this moment. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that kind of effort and work spans not just across geography, but across time as well. And that can perhaps provide a bit of hope in terms of what people have been able to fight for and gain against seemingly insurmountable odds in the past.
What I found, which is slightly depressing, honestly, in all this research and collecting, is there can be a newspaper article from the 70s or 80s. Pick a decade, a date. All you have to do is change the date to today's date, and it's still valid. And it is mind-boggling that either people don't care about history, we're not learning from history. I honestly don't know what the answer to that is, because as I said, yes, we've come a long way. You know, I will admit that, but we have so much further to go, especially to make our community as inclusive as possible. I mean, it's just not there. I wish it were. And so if this could help at all, great. I would be thrilled.
Part of any historical work involves building an archive, stories, artifacts that become kind of their own entity and tell a particular story about communities or people or time or places. I'm just curious from your own perspective how creating and building a kind of queer archive, an archive that is focused around LGBTQ people and identities and struggles, how has that been unique or maybe different than other archival projects that you've been a part of or efforts that you've done as a historian?
I think for me personally, building the archive and some of the uniqueness about it is because it is LGBTQ. I mean, that right there makes it unique. As far as bringing stuff in, I didn't really do anything different than any other curator would do. You reach out to people, see if they have anything. And honestly, a lot of people, no, I don't have anything. I wish I did. I don't have anything. Then I invite them in, you know, to see the museum, and I show them some of the stuff I brought in. They're like, oh, I have that. And so people don't realize what they have is historically important. For me personally, I honestly don't know if I would have anything to donate. I moved a few years ago and pretty much threw everything away because I didn't think I would need it. But, like, for instance, Governor Polis, his tennis shoes, a pair of his tennis shoes was donated and is in our collection now. Well, my tennis shoes aren't important. Nobody's going to want my tennis shoes. And so that's what makes it sort of unique in that as the curator of LGBTQ history, that spans all of our collections, artifacts, art and design, photographs, manuscript collections. So I've brought in everything I just mentioned. So it's under me, and I'm responsible for bringing it in and processing it, but ultimately it's under other curators' collections. So it is still my collection, but that, I think that's what's a little different. If you're the photo curator, obviously you're bringing in photographs or glass plate negatives or what have you. Books and manuscripts pretty much tells you right there what's involved in that. So that's why I feel mine's a little different just because I am collecting from all these different areas and trying to get people to see that they do have items of value for this collection.
As you look towards the future, is there anything, so in the immediate future, what's next for you? So we've got this Rainbows and Revolutions exhibition coming up at History Colorado, but, you know, as you look at future projects or things, I know this is, you know, the third year of funding for your role, so that might mean there's some changes coming, but I wonder if there's also any thoughts you have about, like, this kind of growing archive that you said that has grown from under 100 to now around 500. Any hopes or aspirations you have for that archive itself as well?
Yeah, the hopes I have for this archive, and I said this maybe a year ago when I was talking to somebody, is that I hope I'm building a really good foundation that other people can then build on in the many years to come. I mean, obviously, I'm not going to be around forever, so I hope what I'm doing inspires other people to want to do it and to add to what I've done, because we all have different experiences. And again, in doing this, taking this position, I wasn't aware of a lot of this history, and it's local history. You know, way back when we started talking today, we talked about statewide, and we do have some stories from other parts of the states, but very few artifacts. So I'm hoping that the exhibit will bring more attention to the collecting, and people from outside the Denver metro area will see it and will have items to donate. You know, a lot of stuff we talk about, even though it might not be specific to one part of the state, like Amendment 2, for example, had statewide implications. You know, I mean, Amendment 2 ended up having nationwide because Colorado became the hate state and boycotted. So that, I guess, to answer your question, is that I hope I'm building a really good foundation that somebody will want to continue long after I'm gone.
I wonder, too, about listeners who might be thinking, oh, wait a minute, I'm hearing Aaron talk and I'm realizing maybe I have some things. What's the process to reach out to you, and what would happen to people's artifacts or things? Can you give us a little window into what you do once you identify things that become a part of the collection?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So if somebody were to be listening right now and have something they want to donate, they can email curator@state.us.co.us. I'll give you that information. You can put it on your website if you'd like. They fill out a form on there. It goes to me. Mark on there that it's for the LGBTQ collection. It goes to me, and then I call them and talk to them about it. if it is something we want in the collection, then I'll either go pick it up from them, or they can bring it in, or they can send it to us, whatever's easiest. I actually do like going and picking stuff up. I picked up an amazing piece doing that because the guy wasn't even planning on donating this piece of art. It was this other stuff he was donating. And when I saw it, I was like, hey, what's that? And he's like, oh, you like it? And so if I wouldn't have gone to pick that up, I never would have saw that. And it's amazing. Anyhow, so once I talk to somebody and if they do want to donate, they just fill out a simple form, an RFD, receiver deposit. List everything that they are going to donate. Then I fill out an APF, acquisition proposal form. Then once a month, at the beginning of every month, we have what's called collections committee. All the curators get together and I plead the case for what I want to add to the collection and everybody says yes. And then it goes, then it's officially in the collection. Our registrar sends the donor a deed. And once they sign the deed, then I can start processing it and photographing it, putting it in exhibits. But until we get that deed back, it's not technically ours yet.
And as we wrap up our conversation today, what do people who want to attend Rainbows and Revolutions need to know about that? If they're interested in attending, when is it available? When can they come to History Colorado to see that?
Yeah, so Rainbows and Revolutions will open to the public June 4th. That is, in the past, when we open an exhibit, there's all these nights that lead up to it. Donor appreciation, VIP, membership. But we're moving away from that to basically community events, if you will. So it's going to open on the same day as the event that night. So it's June 4th. After June 4th, come anytime while the museum's open, obviously, to see it. And it'll be up for about 6 months. It'll go through the beginning of the new year.
As we wrap up, any other final thoughts you want to leave our listeners with?
Yes, I do have one. A question you asked me probably 20 minutes ago. My favorite artifact I brought in. I can choose between all of them. I brought in a painting. It's called, I can't remember the process that's used, but in layman's term, hot wax painting. And this woman, she works at DAM. She's amazing. Oh, she's amazing. I can't speak enough good things about her. Her name's Maya. She identifies as queer. And so she did this hot wax painting because it's a painting of her brother and his best friend. And her brother is trans and 13 and not having an easy time of it. Anyhow, when this painting is just amazing. Maya is, I can't wait for everybody to see this painting because she's an amazing person. And I hope someday I can afford to own one of her pieces. It's so great.
You've been listening to Outsources on KGNU Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins. I'm Sean Kenny, and I've been talking with Aaron Marcus about the Rainbows and Revolutions exhibition at History Colorado. Aaron, thanks so much for joining me again on the show.
Thank you so much, Sean.
For more information about Aaron Marcus's work at History Colorado, as well as the upcoming Rainbows and Revolutions exhibition, go online to our website at news.kgnu.org and click on Outsources under the Shows and Features tab. There you can find links with more information about the exhibition, as well as a link to our previous interview with Aaron in 2020. As always, let us know if you have comments or feedback about tonight's show by emailing outsources@kgnu.org.